Welcome to Whistleblowers. We stay in the fight. Episode 18, Series 1. You're listening to the music of The Good Cop. Today's episode takes us into the world of a retired policeman here in Sydney, Australia. A name we've mentioned before, and a name who has become a little bit of a cult figure on the podcast circuit. Today we're talking about a good cop, retired detective Gary Jubelin. Good morning, Jennifer Stone.
Good morning, Glenn.
And welcome to this episode of All Things Gary Jubelin. And we've had so many inquiries about this guy. I mean, you and I have listened to his podcast series. We can't wait each week for the latest in his series, I Catch Killers. And he's become like a cult figure here in Sydney, Australia, where he does his podcast, and we've invited Gary onto our podcast as well. And this morning we thought we'd help people understand who Gary is, and then we might link into what has come up for you in terms of Gary Jubelin's latest podcast. So Gary Jubelin is a former Australian police detective, widely known on the mid-north coast of New South Wales for investigating the murders of Matthew Leveson and the three Bowraville children. Both of those podcasts are available for people who are interested in listening to them. Matthew Leveson and Bowraville children. Gary also caught public attention for leading investigation on the William Tyrrell disappearance case, which we've mentioned here on Whistleblowers, and we're keeping our listeners up to date with the unfolding complexities and the recent hearings that were held for the William Tyrrell disappearance. The body has never been found. Now, Gary was the lead investigator. Sadly, no longer in the police force. Most recently, Gary was the headline after being convicted of illegally recording pensioner Paul Savage. Jubelin was fined $10,000 for the crime. So who is Gary Jubelin? Where's he from? And what is his life story? Well, we won't go too far into that, but we'll give you enough information to say, here is what we know so far. As we started with Gary Jubelin's bio, age and height, we read on to learn more. Gary is currently 57 years old. He is Australian, born in Paddington, Australia. His birth name is Gary Jubelin. He was born in the year 1962, so he's a little bit older than Jen and I, similar age group. And his precise birth date is not advertised. Gary Jubelin isn't very active on social media, including Twitter and Instagram, only through his podcast. His birthplace is Paddington, which is right next to the CBD of Sydney, Australia. And Gary Jubelin worked for over 34 years in homicide detective. Back in 2016, he opened up about his work with journalist Jutta Schulberg. He said, "I've had such a varied career. Police work has opened so many doors for me. I worked in London on the Gordon Wood matter, which we covered on Whistleblowers. Yeah. Wood was convicted of the murder of model Carolyn Byrne, which you would have heard about in a previous episode.
Overturned. He's now an honest man because the courts overturned it.
And the conviction, as Jen said, was later overturned. Gary Jubelin's also been in Hong Kong, Shanghai, Beirut, Canada, Fiji, New Zealand and Paris as a result of his career. He's worked in close personal protection, including with the then Prime Minister John Howard for a few weeks, accompanying him on his morning walks. We all remember the tracksuit. And when the Olympics were in Sydney, Gary took care of heads of state from Turkey and Bulgaria. Gary also said he had never thought about being a policeman until he saw police chasing a bad guy through Ryde. He was 22 years old at the time, working on a building site, and thought that looked like something he wouldn't mind doing. The next day, he signed up for the job. Gary Jubelin also admits he can't imagine having a normal life. I actually really like the pressure, and I'd die of boredom doing anything else, he said. Is Gary married? Well, despite having 3 decades long career as a detective, the 57-year-old keeps his personal life under the radar. Nothing much is revealed about his wife and children. Whether he is married and his wife is yet to be confirmed. We understand that Gary is currently single. His biography is available in the internet, doesn't leave much hints about his partner. And why should it? Gary grew up in the city and spent most of his childhood in Epping, New South Wales. In his family, he has 2 sisters and a brother and supportive parents. Outside of his job, as he talks about in his podcast, he enjoys martial arts, qigong, meditation, yoga, boxing, surfing and riding motorbikes. I'm into the yin-yang of things. Meditation and qigong help give me perspective so I can check myself when things are getting stressful. So he's quite a guy, Jennifer Stone, and we've come in this morning playing the good cop music. He has become a cult figure here in Sydney, Australia. People love to listen to his podcasts with his ex-colleagues from the police force talking about all kinds of murder and crime, which we all remember from the news stories of the day, and sadly, many unsolved crimes that Gary's been a part of, including the William Tyrrell case. We would love you to come on this show, Gary. We would love to come in here. We've got some more questions that we'd like to ask you. We love you. We think you're great. And we love your podcast. But we know it's a very commercial world, this podcast era. And we don't make any money from our podcast yet. But we do like to ask questions. And the reason we call ourselves whistleblowers is we just live on the periphery of what's in the mainstream media, what the quiet Australians are being told. We go beyond that a little bit and we stretch the realms. And Jen's work as a criminal investigative journalist for decades now in the King's Cross and wider Sydney and also international arena has brought to light many little snippets of information that have been passed on to police and have led to some major convictions and unravelling of crime. So the police do come knocking on Jen's door occasionally to find out what she's up to, what intel she's got, and just to help them break out of their straitjacket of police thinking and go beyond. So, Jen, look, we could go on forever. I'm not going to go on forever. People get tired of my voice. But this morning, you mentioned 2 words, Deborah Wallace.
Deborah Wallace was the lead detective. She was in charge of Strikeforce Constance in 2009 under Task Force BAX, B-A-X. And that evolved after that into Strikeforce Raptor. And that's when I started my investigations, were in 2009. So I kind of think we both started at the same time unravelling. But by 2011, I'd worked it out. So why hadn't she? That was where my mindset was.
So each week Jen comes in here and she came early today, so I knew something was on the cards, but she had some information that she wanted to talk about. This is what we know.
Mike's putting us in jail. So we call her the Smiling Assassin.
That's a pretty cool nickname.
So that's from Gary's podcast, The Smiling Assassin, Deborah Wallace. Deborah talks to Gary in that episode. They call you the Smiling Assassin.
Yes, the assassin. It intrigued me. Why would she come out and say, after 12 months of being retired, I'm known as the Smiling Assassin? Because I thought of as an assassin as a hitman. But within the crimes that I write about, the drug dealers importing the drugs into Australia, a lot of the time, by the third time, so the first time the drug deal would happen, or it'd be rosy. This is how I was taking it. The second time, in most events, so what happens when the drugs hit our shore? It comes in three lots. So they're dealing with six to maybe more importers at a time, the police. Now, what we notice is the police would get two lots and one lot it'd always get through. And in some cases, we knew about different lots getting through and we go, no, there's one missing, and we'd hit hard on emails to get them to pick up the third lot. In the last couple of weeks, we've had three lots caught. One a million odd, another one was a million odd, and then there was a 400 million. Now, that was a large haul by the AFP. And I know that some of them are very cleverly designed and put together, and you start to think, wow, how is this happening, you know? But in King's Cross, it seems to, they never run out of drugs. And that is something where the police are monitoring the end user to make sure they're still getting the drugs. Then at the end, in the beginning, well, we haven't stopped the drugs coming in. So we've missed somebody. And it's a theory that they've been working on for a while. And it's evolved because they didn't know about the three shipments. That was one of the things I was telling them.
All right. Well, let's just go back a little bit before we come to the current day situation. When Jen came in early this morning, she said, Glenn, have you heard about the end of church night? I went, church night? We don't talk about church much in here. But Jen said, this is a different type of church night, and you'll hear it in Gary Jubelin's podcast. There we go. That's from Gary's podcast, and a little plug there for Gary. It's a fantastic series. But church night, the end of church night, as Deb Wallace put it. Just run us through what church night is from a King's Cross perspective.
Well, King's Cross on a Friday night, you think, you know, maybe in the 80s and late 70s was high-flying, plenty of drugs, rock and roll, sex. And the spirit of King's Cross was very much alive. That spirit's nearly gone now because the streets are dead. You're lucky to see someone walking along. Even McDonald's doesn't have queues anymore. So you can see that the number of people in King's Cross has gone down.
And just interrupting, the reason for that, for people who don't know, the King's Cross area was the nightclub strip and the action part of Sydney for many years. And they brought in some lockout laws a few years ago and virtually closed the pubs down early and closed a lot of the entertainment venues. They shut down. And so, as Jen's saying, the once nightclub, Night Strip area is now filled with apartment blocks, young families, there's kids, there's women with strollers walking through there of a night time. Sydney people can't believe what's happened to their cultural life spot. So go on.
So in King's Cross on a Friday night, people would call it the Black Church or Black Friday. And they would go to a church. It linked to the times of Rosaline Norton in King's Cross. So she would hold this church. Now, if you go back through the research, her church linked into Aleister Crowley, known as the wickedest man on earth. And he needed 150 children to feed him. He was known as the Beast, 666 in Revelations. So we have 777 is the link in King's Cross to Porky's, and it links because it's on 77 Darlinghurst Road. It's like the Bible coming alive. And we have the 666, and we have the 22 for the beef and bourbon, and that's what I link into, the gang known linking to the 22.
And the beef and bourbon we've mentioned in previous podcasts.
Yes, but Gary Jubilee would be seen there.
It's a nightclub, it's a bar, yes, with three levels. So the bourbon and beefsteak, or the bourbon as it's known now, is one of the giant clubs which still is existing. And it's a place where tourists go, it's a place where locals go, and it's also been, over the years, a late night revelers hotspot. So Gary Jubilant and the bourbon and beefsteak, what brought that link together?
Well, the beef and bourbon was known to have Abe Saffron around. It had Roger Rogerson would be known going in and out the back door. So it had some notorious part of the criminality in King's Cross coming alive through the beef and bourbon. But the 22 is a link to the 22 parts to the skull they collect. And Rosaline Norton, if you Google her and have a look at her images, she will be seen with a skull in her hands.
And who was Rosaline Norton?
Well, she was known as the Witch of King's Cross. And she practiced this, like, imaginary, the life of Pan, the god, and bringing it alive in her art. She was really into the art. But a lot of the time, the photographs of her are shown sitting in a gutter out the front of where I once searched. So she would hang around that area. She would put her art in a cafe called the Apollo and the Apollon. And she was a notoriety person. People knew her, but it was this weird sense of, like, a cult that was happening. So when she died, there were 200 people that were attending this black church, this Black Friday church. The chemists would put signs up going to church on Black Friday. So it was all known about in King's Cross, and everyone was happy about it. But really, what was it, and what was this church? Well, I expose it as part of an organised criminal gang, that this was the basis. Aleister Crowley knew the Bible backwards as well as forwards. His knowledge was very vast of it, and he was utilised to create, as I allege, a system where within the rituals, satanic rituals, the murder does happen.
Okay, let's have a listen to this. King's Cross, as it used to be. The bright lights, the crowds, the hustle and bustle. Footage shot from the early 2000s. This is a Friday night in King's Cross. Church night. Thousands and thousands of party revelers. And a hotbed of organised crime.
You would have been able to get cocaine, heroin, ice, drugs, Xanax, whatever you wanted. Very easy.
So that's from a documentary called Sydney's King's Cross Nightlife, and people can see that on YouTube. So the organised crime had a market on a Friday night and often Saturday night in King's Cross, and you've mentioned the black magic. So there's a system. This links into a system. And you went on to say, Rosalie and the Apollo Club, you never actually knew where the gang members met.
No, I had a few leads. One lead was to an old shut-down ex-casino known as the Diamond Horseshoe Theatre. And it was a link into Sammy Lee, and Sammy Lee linked to the Lay Girls and to King's Cross and to the Pink Pussycat Club back in the 70s. But Abe always got his girls' drugs. And no one ever questioned it. No one ever thought, where are the drugs are coming from? And I got told about these drugs that were, you know, in wrappers in garbage bins that were getting carried around. No one would look at you moving a garbage bin. No. No one would look, you know, and you start to think, that's a lot of drugs. That's a lot of money. And cash was the economy. You know, when they checked the ATMs, and I was only looking at them from maybe 2010 onwards, they were full of money, absolutely full. And every shop had an ATM. And you started to think, there's a bloody lot of money up here. Where did it all come from? You know, and some of the guys went, oh, that's my takings from a shop. And I'm thinking, God, I haven't seen anyone coming here buying, you know, and it'd be like a corner, you know, like a, you know, buy a can of Coke or a chocolate or a chips. Yeah, it wasn't a shop that would make thousands in a day. Even on a busy night in King's Cross, and I can remember seeing head-to-head across Darlinghurst Road, and people in some of these shops they wouldn't go to. And that was something that I started to learn about, that the gang was there, and they'd tell people, don't go there, don't go there. And those shops would then close because they weren't involved in the gang. This is one gang that rules the drug network across Australia, and that's the gang that the Strike Force Raptor was formed to expose. But even in New South Wales, and why hadn't they exposed in King's Cross? Then a smiling assassin, he's normally a hitman. Well, you think of three containers coming in with six different people involved in them at times, or loading onto fishing trawlers, but the police have not been able to find the money trail of them buying the drugs in some cases. So you start to think, well, how did these people get so much free drugs to begin with? And how did they control them? And the only way I came up with was that they did a murder, the evidence was collected, and then held as a trophy by the big boys in town.
Wow, so there we go. You know, you said you'd love to ask Deb Wallace a few more questions about how it all unfolded with the, you know, she went into the conviction and the arrest of many gang members. And what you're saying now is that this behaviour is going on today. And here's a little grab about police are on the hunt for those responsible for a recent fatal shooting in Sydney.
The 44-year-old was peppered with bullets as he left his Condell Park home yesterday morning before staggering to a friend's house where he died on the doorstep. CCTV of two men carrying out the murder has now been seized by police.
I heard eight gunshots, which of course brought me to the window. As I've looked out, I've seen two gunmen crossing the road straight to the car. As they had the body, no, by Clarber on there.
Witnesses believe the getaway car, later torched in Yagoona, was parked on the street the night before.
It sounded just like one gun because it was bang, 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 bang.
One of Majid Hamsi's cousins posting online, "Your blood won't go to waste." As police revealed, Brothers for Life gang founder Bazem Hamsi's been told his brother's dead.
And does his brother in prison?
He's been spoken to. He does know about it.
Police are investigating several motives, one being Majid Hamsi was targeted in an ongoing drug turf war, or he was killed due to his suspected involvement in another gangland murder. Either way, it's believed this was a hit carried out by a professional killer.
We will be targeting associates and known offenders. They can expect us to be in their face. They know we'll come knocking on their door.
Hannah Sinclair, Nine News.
So the good work of Deb Wallace and Gary Jubelin goes on today. You mentioned this particular case. It's unfolding in Sydney. Often people come to Sydney and think, what a beautiful place. It's all so serene, Sydney Harbour and innocent. But crime is alive and well, and organised crime is alive and well on the Sydney streets, as we can see there. And how does this link into what you were just saying about King's Cross and drugs?
Well, they link into the gangs as they're fighting each other. But really, when the police professional standards or the Integrity Commission or the ICAC or some people are watching a criminal person, the AFP even, the gang seems to know. And that person then gets shot because of this wall of silence. Now, that's a theory. But that theory played out for the Rogerson case, for the shooting of Jamie Gaya. He was talking to the commission, the Australian Crime Commission.
Yeah.
And that's the reason I believe he was shot.
Yeah.
So that was to keep the big boys quiet. And we got to remember that the drugs were coming in the tiles. And his mother linked into the tiles back then, but she's now gone back to China.
Interesting. And, you know, you mentioned the ethnic groups, you know, the gangs, as we just heard, the Lebanese gangs and the Afghan gangs are two of the more prominent ones in Sydney at the moment. Where are they based and what's happening there?
Well, they subdivided the Brothers for Life into two gangs, and the Hamsi family link into Brothers for Life. I link into a couple of the Brothers for Life linking into the Nomads. So it started, I thought they were called the Bankstown Boys back in 2011. That's what most people were saying, oh, they come from Bankstown, they come from Bankstown. But what they kind of have is the Parramatta sector, which is the Lebanese link, and the Blacktown, which is the Afghan link. But it's interesting that the Parramatta chapter, so in the past, Hell's Angels Parramatta chapter linked to being changed over into the Bandidos through a $6 million payout to all its members. The problem is that that is exactly the same figure as was taken by armoured car robberies in just a previous couple of years. So you start to think not even $1 went to these thugs. They were honest for the big boys in town. So then you start to go back in the history, and Sam Ibrahim links to the Parramatta chapter, and he became a life member of the Nomads. And you start to think there's more to this, to these patterns, than what the police have focused on. They were going around and catching a bad guy, but forgetting about who was feeding them the drugs. So even though at the time when I first started, I think there were about 10 or maybe more players in a drug run, now it'd be more like 4 or 5. But they'd still be moving the same amount of drugs, but have less people.
And finally, you mentioned your previous work on, you know, the theory of this, looking at the scorpion.
Yes, the scorpion. Back when I first started, the scorpion was a mark on the cocaine packets, But in King's Cross, I noticed the scorpion tattoo would come on the hand. And Alex had a scorpion tattoo that he had put on. And he said to me, this is going to open up doors. And I went, how's that work? But really, this gang of the scorpions that are the elite within the gangs in King's Cross, they don't know who else is in the gang. It's just they get the tattoo. So when they shake hands, they know they've come across another gang member. This is how the secret society work. It's the handshake. You know, we learn about the handshake from the Freemasons, but this has just evolved. So the tattoo's like the mark. And what I noticed is one of the Brothers for Life members, he would have had a tattoo of a scorpion, but it's all been blacked out when I was looking at the photographs. But Michael Ibrahim has the tattoo of the scorpion on his hand. So, which is John Ibrahim's brother, though he's behind bars now for life, or nearly for life. I'd say when he gets more charges, as time will come, as he's just been charged lately, that things will happen and people will start to see these patterns. You know, when a person's murdered, 98% of the time, it's someone they know. And that's why the police focus on in the missing persons, on the families. And why is the person missing, you know? Michelle Podgmore is one of those, but she was found murdered in Blacktown in a dumpster. And she was actually, that in some of the intelligence that I've been able to read, she was actually taken to a party. So was it one of these church parties? And then she got returned and put in a dumpster in Blacktown. Now, allegedly, the person that was that found the body, some people say he was making the eyes. So it's just like, whoa, 98%? Did she know the guy? Was she on the drugs? You don't know. They seem to get hooked one use and they're gone.
Yeah.
You know, that drug ice is very deadly. Soul destroying.
Yeah, very much so. And this has been a wonderful episode. Look, we're going to end it there today. We hope you've enjoyed Whistleblowers today. Jen, we might come back and do an episode in coming weeks on King's Cross again and the unfolding saga of the Harmsey murder and the tit-for-tat gang murders that are going on in Sydney in November 2020 under the cover of COVID and the pandemic. But our hearts go out to the officers that have been gunned down or killed in the execution of their duties. And this is the music, The Good Cop. And for those that haven't heard it, I Catch Killers by Gary Jubelin is a fantastic podcast to listen to learn more about the crimes that Jen talks about here and some of the organised crime and murders that have happened in recent times in Sydney, Australia. So please like us on Facebook, Instagram. That's Whistleblowers, episode 18. We'll see you next week with Jen Stone.
To do.